The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to August and another episode of Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. Today, I'm one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
I'm one of your other hosts, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And I am your last host, Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
Before we start our topic today, I just want to check in with my co-hosts, since I haven't seen you for a while, see what's going on in your life. I would like you to say something that is a win or went well for you in the last 24 hours, something that didn't go quite as well for you, and something you're looking forward to in the future. Who wants to start?
I think Mike is burning to talk.
Sure. Something that went well. So I was asked kind of out of the blue by this extension person that I know a little bit or knew a little bit before she reached out. She is organizing a small project. We got a small $10,000 grant to look at biodiversity in bioswales, which are like, instead of shunting water down storm drains in cities, you let it go into these larger holding areas and they percolate through the soil and there's plants there. And presumably they help clean the water as it goes back into the environment. And so she asked me if I wanted to go survey insect diversity in these bioswales that they have down in Lancaster County. And I said, yeah, sure. So I made some traps up and she picked them up. She's going to deploy the traps, pick them up, and then just give me the samples. So it's this nice, easy project where like I don't have to do a lot of the field work. And so she picked up the traps today and is setting them out. So that was a win because I get to be involved in this project, but I don't have to do a lot of the legwork, which is good because I don't have time for that.
What are you hoping to find in there?
I don't know. I'm really curious to see what they do find because you can imagine these swales, they're not very big. If I had to guess, we're putting up pan traps for pollinators and ramp traps for terrestrial things.
So is a ramp trap, it's like they just walk
in? Yeah, it's like a pitfall that's above ground. They walk up a ramp and then fall in. My guess is that we're going to get more diversity in pollinators because they can fly between these islands of vegetation and less diversity of terrestrial things. But we'll see. I'm curious about it. The fail, I have four tarantulas, and I have not had tarantulas very long, just like 2 years. And we started getting them because my son wanted to go see some snakes before the pandemic. And so we went to a reptile show to like show him a bunch of snakes. And my wife at the door, there was like a raffle. You put your name in and you could win a tarantula, and she won.
Oh, wow.
So we got our first tarantula, which is hers. So it's our biggest one though. I've got a couple since then.
Is its name Lucky?
No, we didn't.
What kind is it?
So it's an orange baboon tarantula. She is, I don't know, probably a 3-inch leg span. I know intellectually that they are fast. I did not know what that meant until I tried to rehouse this thing. They are fast and defensive, and the bite is extremely painful. And it got out when I was rehousing it and got under the island in the kitchen. I had to pull out all of the pans and pots and things from the island and all the drawers. And then me and Sarah got the island and tipped it onto its side and found the spider underneath. And it then got into like a little hole in the island, and I had to get like the yardstick and poke this thing with my face down there, trying to get it out and hoping it didn't run fast at my face, and then like get it. And I didn't have anything around except a pitcher. So I like poke this thing with the yardstick and it comes screaming out of this island. And I like slam a juice container over top of it. And then it got it contained. It's like, okay, now what? I've got it under this container.
You're like a heart like beating.
Yes.
Out of your chest.
Please tell me you did your best crocodile hunter impression this entire time.
No.
Like, oh, look at this salty fella.
I was too focused on not being bitten.
He was too, and he still talked like that. So
to be fair, that was his voice. I got a piece of something, paper or something, got it under the pitcher, got it into the terrarium, and then Sarah helped me get it out, get the lid on, and now it is safely, securely in its larger terrarium.
So what is that tarantula's name?
It's an orange baboon tarantula. Yeah, but
what's its name? Does it have a name?
Oh, no, none of them have names. As a child, I had a brown bullhead catfish for 12 years, I think. And its name was the catfish. Like, that's just what we called it. That was its name.
Well, so. I guess I call the black widow the black widow.
Yeah. So I often don't name pets that aren't higher organisms, I guess.
We have Benipede.
We did have Benipede.
Well, that tarantula should just be called Kitchen Island.
Yeah.
The Kitchen Island tarantula.
Or like Emerald or Gordon Ramsay or something. Yeah, something chef-themed.
I think it's a female.
That doesn't matter. We've got Kevin. She's a female. She's purple ribbon.
I'll pitch Gordon Ramsay.
Okay, and something that you're looking forward to.
Oh, gosh. I don't know.
Are you doing anything fun after work?
No, I don't. We don't do anything fun.
Oh, my gosh, Mike. Jonathan, do you have a win for today?
We going to let him off the hook without having something to look forward to?
Well, I don't, like, because he's going to be.
Okay, I've got a paper that I've been noodling on for almost a year that is very close to being done. So if I can find time today or tomorrow, I might be able to finish it. I don't want to say more because I don't want to scoop myself. I'm pretty excited about it.
Okay, see, you have one. Jonathan, are you ready now?
I suppose. What are my questions?
See, you guys just need to practice gratitude today. You can't even think of good things. So your question is, like, what is something that went well for you?
That's a hard one. This week started off kind of cruddy.
I know it's only Tuesday. So think about anything. It doesn't have to be.
I got to build a bracelet with my daughter last night. That was fun. Aww.
With string or with beads?
Yeah, string and beads. And she was pretty pumped. We got to use different colors and there are letters. It's not really age appropriate, but I was supervising. So she didn't eat any of the letters. Yeah, the beads are pretty tiny. And I could see her shoving them up her nose if left unsupervised.
Well, I'm glad you were supervising her. I'm sure they're beautiful bracelets.
That was fun. Something that went wrong. I was supposed to be in the field all morning yesterday taking scale insect samples. But I got there and I didn't have any clippers. I'd left them in the lab and then it started raining.
Do you have something that you're looking forward to?
Am I looking forward to anything? Oh, man. I feel sort of similar to Mike. Like, it's kind of hard.
I feel like these are the hardest questions for you guys. You guys need to practice gratitude every day.
I am looking forward to trying and finish my book over lunch. Instead of perusing the internet, I'm going to try and finish Kitchen Confidential.
Ooh.
Whilst I eat my salami.
Salami.
All right, your turn, Jody. What's something that went well for you?
Okay, so right now I have a monarch caterpillar in chrysalis about to close today. So it's been sitting on the reception table. So people are walking by it, seeing it, you know, they're like commenting how beautiful it is. So I'm kind of educating about what a monarch chrysalis looks like. And today it's completely clear. You can see the wings through it. So everyone's just fascinating. And so it's an interesting way to educate just people coming and going. So that I think is a win because people are asking. Sounds like a win. People are talking about it. They've never seen it before. And when it merges, I'm sure people are just going to lose their marbles. Let's see. My fail, which is really kind of not my fail, is just my stinky office. And that now we're all required to be back at the office. And this is the only time my office smells like wet bathing suit because there was some kind of problem with a valve with the refrigerator. And my office doesn't have a window. It backs onto the break room. It's just me having to be here wandering around looking for a place to work. So I've been in cubicles. I've been at the front desk. I'm in the boardroom. I don't even know where to plug this in. Something I'm looking forward to is tonight. I give a talk to a garden club that's super excited to feed me. One, that's exciting.
And two,
listen to me talk about anything about bugs. I'm excited about that.
If I remember that event correctly, it's a potluck too. So it's like all these gardeners that know how to cook and they bring their food and there's like a huge dessert table and there's a huge side dish table and you just are like, yeah, this is Nirvana. This is Valhalla. This is the way Valhalla would work.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Sometimes, like, with some groups, I would be very concerned about a potluck, but I'm not really that concerned with this group.
That sounds exciting. Do you guys find yourself still in the grad student mindset of like, oh, shoot, free food, I got to go to that?
It never goes away.
Yeah, yeah, I think it never goes away. Yeah.
But if we're done talking about that, we're going to talk about ants today, which is the number one insect pest reported by homeowners. Boo. The thing about ants is that I think we as entomologists kind of love them, right? Or understand them, maybe in a way that you can respect them, their life history. Yes, no?
Yeah, they're organized. There's something to be valued with ants.
I think many people, though, can identify an ant as an ant, especially when it doesn't have wings. You know, there's a lot of things people can identify, but when people are like, I think it's an ant. And then when I ask to describe it to me, because usually things are just like a black fuzzy bug or something flying. But with the ant, they always say it's got three body parts, which we know all insects do. They're just not as evident. And then elbowed antennae if they actually look that far. But how would you describe an ant as opposed to a different insect?
I think you're right. Ants have three very obvious body parts because they have constrictions between the head and then between the thorax and abdomen. Although with ants, it's not quite that simple because they're hymenopterans. So it's the gaster. The first segment of the abdomen is actually pushed up and incorporated into the thorax, which is kind of neat. But that's a good way to help people, because often what I get is this a termite or is this an ant? They can't tell the difference if there's a termite infestation, and I tell them to look for those three segments, because in termites, the abdomen is broadly jointed to the thorax, so it looks like there's just one long segment behind the head.
They look like a white sausage.
Well, I was thinking the reproductives.
I think that totally throws people off when they're like, it looks like an ant, but it has wings.
Oh, yeah. Like, they don't recognize that ants have wings.
Oh, yeah. I think that's pretty typical for most people. And that's why they think they're termites, which is interesting.
I can see that.
Mike, can you address like the taxonomy of ants? You did mention that they were like hymenopterans. What other hymenopterans are there? And does it surprise people to think that they are related or in that order?
You know, I don't know if it surprises people. So yeah, Hymenoptera it's a large, diverse, perhaps the most diverse group. It's one of the big four. There's beetles, Hymenoptera, flies, and Lepidoptera, the moths and butterflies. So Hymenoptera are the wasps, the bees, ants, and things that are related like sawflies. Primitively, like other aculeate Hymenoptera, ants have stingers, which some people might recognize. Fire ants can sting you. Some other ants can sting you as well. But a lot of ants, interestingly, especially some of the higher ants, have lost the stinger. So many ants, like carpenter ants and other formicine ants, have what's called an acidopore instead of a stinger. They squirt formic acid or some other acid out. And so a lot of ants that we, at least in North America, at least in northern North America, don't sting or can't sting. So like the big carpenter ants that get in your house, they have an acidopore. They don't have a stinger. They can't sting you. And a lot of the other pest ants, odorous house ants, can't sting either, which is useful for us living up here. We don't have to worry about that so much.
So do they spray?
Yeah, they spray acid instead of stinging.
Does it hurt us? I guess I've never been sprayed.
No, not really. I mean, unless you're like rubbing ants in your eyes, I suppose that might be bad.
And what's wrong with that?
I think one of the things that I've always thought that was interesting, you know, because there's so many different families of insects, and with ants, they're all in one family.
Yeah, it's a really diverse group. But once you get into Formicidae, the family of ants, or the family that contains ants, there are a bunch of different subfamilies. The two main ones that people will be familiar with in our area, and I am speaking mostly from a North American perspective, because once you get into like the tropics, things get wildly different. They have a lot more groups that we don't have here, or have only represented by a handful of species that we don't see very often here. The two biggest groups are Formicinae, the carpenter ants, and the field ants like Formica, Lasius, the cornfield ants, and woodland ants. Those are the ones that have the acidopores that spray acid. The other big group are the myrmecines. Those are primarily, they sting. They're things like fire ants. Some groups that we have in our area are chromatogaster, the acrobat ants, which are neat because they have like a little heart-shaped gaster. Technically, it's the gaster because, again, the first part of the abdomen's in the thorax. But honestly, I use them interchangeably. So listeners know I'm referring to the same bits. They have a heart-shaped gaster, which makes them easily identifiable. They're really cool, too, because the way that their gaster is connected to the thorax, they can put it up over their thorax, and they'll walk around with their stinger out with a little droplet of venom as a warning sign to other ants and other insects. But we also have we have 6 or 8 subfamilies in North America. Things like Ponarini, the really primitive ants. We only have 1 species in Pennsylvania across most of the Northeast. You get a couple more in the South. So a lot of the other subfamilies aren't well represented in our area. Dolichoderini is another one people will be most familiar with, odorous house ants for that group, which is a big pest species. But outside of that pest species, we don't have very many representatives here. They don't have an accidopore. They just have, like, if you look at the abdomen, instead of an accidopore, instead of like an open hole, they have a long slit that they can exude acid from. But yeah, so at the family level, ants aren't diverse. There's just one family of them. But at the subfamily and the genus level, they're quite diverse. They're one of the more diverse groups of insects in our region.
Can you speak to any of their history as a group? Like, are they old insects? Have they been around for a long time in the fossil record? Or are they pretty recent arrivals on planet Earth?
Oh, gosh. They are fairly recent. They, I believe, arose in the Cretaceous at some point. We do have amber fossils of ants in lots of them. They're one of the more common inclusions that you get in amber fossils, because you can imagine like ants running up and down trees. Like, that's where you may get amber. If we're thinking about extinct ants, one of the neatest groups that there are the hell ants. Have you guys heard of these?
Can't say that I have.
No.
Sounds like something from a comic book, though.
Yeah, so it's this entire lineage, an entire subfamily of ants that are all now extinct. The first one was only described, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. But in that time, there have been a couple papers that have come out. And it looks like the group is actually fairly diverse at the end Cretaceous and maybe into post-KT boundary. But there's something like 10 or 20 species that are described now. And they have this mechanism that is unknown in any other ants. They've got these really wild, like, mandibles in parts of the head that most ants, you can imagine the mandibles.
They're opposing.
Yeah, opposing. Like, they work in a horizontal manner. But hell ants, they go up and down. So they
look like anglerfish.
Yeah, they have this trap jaw that they like move in opposition to like a projection that comes off the head. And it looks like a big trap. They're really cool. And the entire group is extinct.
I'm going to count us lucky for that.
Ha! Yeah, they're really wild looking. It's a shame that we don't have any representatives left. Like, for such a diverse group, it's weird to me that there's not like a single living representative.
Right.
You'd think that there'd be like one relic somewhere living on an island or something, but
maybe deep in the bowels of subterranean Earth.
Maybe. If we're thinking about extinct ants, I think that's a really neat group. And again, it's only in the last decade or so that they were even discovered and described. And since then, they've figured out that they're actually fairly diverse.
It says here, amber deposits in France, Myanmar, and Canada.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that there were Canadian representatives. Looking at AntWiki, total of 9 genera and 14 species are now described. All but 2 genera and 3 species have been described in the last 10 years as of 2020. So yeah, it's a really, like, we're just now discovering that this is a really diverse group.
Wait, time out.
On extinct.
So yeah. This ant wiki, so is this a Wikipedia just for ants?
Yes. So it's the same way that like Wikipedia is an encyclopedia. It works off the wiki model where anybody can edit it if you have editor status. It looks like Wikipedia, but it's just entirely for ants. Another really good reference and resource is AntWeb.
Jonathan, do you have a relationship with ants? Do you have ants in your house?
I don't have any ants in my house, as far as I know right now. My relationship with ants, I know Mike has like a long one. He even talked about it, I think, a little bit in our ESA webinar that we did just recently where it sounded like ants were pretty formative to Mike's entomological experiences. Am I remembering that correctly, Mike?
Ants were one of the groups that got me into entomology. I haven't done as much with them recently in like studying ants as its whole subfield of entomology.
Right.
But I like working with them. They're really good. You know, they're fairly diverse in a lot of places. They're easy to collect. I like working with them when I can.
My angle comes from much more of a like practical or SciComm kind of thing, I think, where I think ants are easy to talk to people about. People have experiences with ants. People have flipped over rocks and seen ants. People have expectations of ants. They kind of know what they are and what they do. And I also have dealt with them a lot just as an extension professional with people complaining about them. I know that for some reason, ants bug a lot of folks. Like they just don't like ants. They don't like seeing them. They don't like thinking about them. I find it kind of odd when people are so sort of vociferous about their hatred of ants. It seems weird to me. Like I remember distinctly, I had an extension client when I was in Nebraska who came to me with a bag of ants that he had captured. And he said, "What are these?" And I looked at them and I don't even remember what kind of ants they were, but we were talking about them. And I said, "Oh, so where in your house did you find them?" And he said, "Oh, they weren't in my house. I just need to know how to get rid of them." And I said, "Well, if they're not in your house, where did you find them?" And he said, "Oh, I bought an acreage and I flipped over a rock outside and there they were on the back end of the property. And don't I need to do something about it?" It's like, no, you're the jerk here. You're the pest. You invaded their house and knocked off their roof. It's hard, I think, to overcome for some reason this weird, is it hatred or is it just like gross outness of ants? It's a weird relationship that some people have with them. But it's fun to try and talk to them about how important ants are. I know also from sort of a landscape entomologist perspective, when you think about ants, I think of them as these like roving gangs of predators that take down huge amounts of prey items. They need to feed a lot of mouths in the colony. And so they eat a lot of grubs. They eat a lot of pest caterpillars. They do a lot of free pest control, basically. If you have them in the environment, in the landscape, you're basically getting free pest control for room and board. It seems like a good setup if you can get it.
Mm-hmm. I think they're like the cleanup crew. Like
that's a good way of putting it.
Seeing things moving in the mulch or somewhere, and you look down and there's this huge, like, I don't know, dragonfly wing or something like moving. And you're like, how is that happening? And they're like ants, right? Or just this giant caterpillar being dragged along and you see like one ant. And then like, I can't help but stop and watch because I'm like, wow, where are you going? How do you know where you're going? And where's your calling? Like, why don't you have help? And then, you know, you can come back and look. And the thing is like 20 feet away.
Right.
And she's dragged it all the way there. And then you'll see other ones. And I'm like, I'm not sure if they're even helping. Like they feel like they're pulling them away. And
to watch them pick up stuff or to watch them work in teams where they drag a whole nightcrawler seemingly back towards the nest. I think that's all fascinating. I don't know why it sets so many people off. I've often wondered, and I think we talked about this when we did the movie Them.
Them.
And we talked about, I think, a little bit that. And maybe this is sort of an American thing or a NATO nation thing. Like when I talk to people, they equate ants to communists. They say things like, oh, ants remind me of communism because they all work together and have a single direct leader. I'm not sure if there's some sort of like, quote unquote, democratic prejudice against ants or if that factors into why people don't like to see them around. There is this weird cultural connotation attached to them of being almost a communist society. Mike, do you think that matches up with biology?
So I'm just trying to wrap my head around that. I've not encountered that. Do you notice?
You've never had anybody bring that up, really?
No.
I get that all the time. It's really weird. People are like, oh yeah, ants, especially if they're red, if it's a reddish colored ant, are they communists? Like, don't they remind you of communism?
Is it older folks like that lived through the Cold War?
Yeah. Absolutely.
I would find it really strange to have like a 20-some-year-old like, yeah, these red communist ants. Like,
it is older folks that have brought it up for sure.
That makes much more sense. I have not experienced that.
Do you have a refutation to somebody saying that? Like, I mean, we're not a political show, so we don't have to get into communism versus socialism and everything, but they are working together cooperatively. We're talking about a eusocial critter. So
explain that. Explain what a eusocial insect.
There's a hierarchy within the nest of the ants. So there's a queen who's the reproductive. There's a cast of workers that are doing the labor. I'm actually not super well versed in all of the castes within an ant colony as much as I am with like a honeybee colony per se. I know it gets a little different in an ant nest. Maybe Mike can speak to some of that a little more, but there's divisions of labor. There is a ruler over the nest. And then there's a collective group of female workers that are out and about doing most of the tasks that the colony needs. Am I way off base, Mike?
No, that's pretty on. It's weird to equate it to communism though, because like you think about this, at least Soviet style communism and oh gosh. No, just like I'm thinking about my American upbringing and what we've learned about, like we conflate socialism and communism here and there's
absolutely
slavery, like Soviet and Cuban and Maoist style communisms are all very different, but I don't know enough about any of them to really distinguish them. But
we're not a history podcast. We're not a geopolitical podcast,
but you know,
just
thinking
like
about,
ants,
but thinking about in at least Soviet style communism, where you've got directives, like we want this region to produce this or this factory to produce X numbers of this thing. Like, that doesn't happen with ants. There's no, even though they are working for the collective of the colony, there's no like overarching, like nobody's giving orders. They're all responding to like chemical cues that their fellows are giving off.
That's actually part of it though. I talk to these people about it, it's that there's like a strict order that's imposed upon them. There's no free will, quote unquote.
But there is no order imposed upon them. Like they're not taking
orders. I'm just
saying,
well, yeah. But they're taking a chemical cue. Like they don't get to choose. You know, you get to choose to be an entomologist. The ant is having a direct communication of here's the formic acid. Here's what you're going to do.
Right.
People have said to me.
Sure.
They don't have the choice to be a sterile worker, but they still have to cooperatively care for these young.
In these people's minds, when I've spoken to them, they don't have, it's all, you're told what to do. There's no free will. I know this is a weird thing to talk about with insects. And maybe I shouldn't
have brought
it up at all. But in this colony, it's all set up for you. You have no choice. It's a mindless operation. And I think that a lot of these people, they have that sort of expectation of quote unquote communism, whatever that means in their head.
Sure. I guess I would argue that ants don't work like that. It's not mindless. Like they are responding to cues, but we respond to cues all the time. Like we respond to other people telling us things or emailing us. Like we're not totally independent.
I think we're getting into some philosophical territory.
Yeah. I've never encountered that. I guess I'm not surprised. That's just it's a weird holdover from the Cold War, I guess.
It's a weird take, yeah. If other people have heard that out there, let us know. Send us a message or something.
I think when people dislike ants so much, they just squish it. So they have no time to observe and see how cool they are or what they're doing. They squish it, and then they know that there's going to be more. Sometimes you see a bug, if you don't like them, an insect or pest or whatever, you're like, oh, well, it could just be one. But when you see an ant, you know that there's more. And that alone makes people hate them.
Yeah, the sheer numbers of the situation, the idea that they're going to invade your home en masse and come in and steal your food or your garbage or whatever. I do think that sets people off. I also think people have a thing about ants touching them, which goes back to the stinging that Mike was talking about, but also just the sensation of bugs on us. It's called formication, the idea that ants are crawling on us. So we have this thing with ants being on us even or around us. You're itching now that I brought it up. So
I can see that. Like you sit down and you don't know you're sitting on an ant nest, and then all of a sudden you're covered and you've
crawling. Yeah.
Like you've got crawling things all over you. Like it's you know, a sudden, like if they're not there and then they're all there.
I was taking down field tents. I had my bumblebees in, and I hadn't gotten stung by bumblebees that day, and I was very proud of myself, but I put my knee down on top, apparently, of what I think was a pavement ant nest, maybe, based on what I saw from them, and all of a sudden, they were all up my shorts and my knee, and do they pinch and sting, Mike?
They bite. They can sting, although I'm not sure it's a very strong sting.
It wasn't very potent, but it was very annoying.
Since they've bitten us more than they would sting.
Yeah. They were just all up and down my calf being very angry.
Yeah, that happens. Like
and
even
then I
if
felt
you
them for the rest of the day.
Yep, just like on you, even though they're not.
Yeah. But when you're an entomologist and you feel like something's crawling on you, there probably is something crawling on you.
That is true.
I don't know. I think it's interesting that people expect to not see ants, whereas I expect that there are ants outside everywhere. I guess that's where they're supposed to be to me. I don't know. I have a really small, like, I can't even imagine how many ant colonies you have on your property, Mike. But I mean, I just have a really small little place, and I know I have at least 5 or 6 different species of ants, and I know where they are and I know what they're doing. And if I see them in a different place, you know, I'm like, what are you doing here?
I should do an ant survey. I don't know how many I've got here.
Yeah. I can't even imagine. I'm sure there's like, our place is so small, and I'm like, oh my gosh, we have the citronella ants here. They swarm in November. We have these here, these two fight, and I'll come back and I'll see who wins. Always the pavement ants. They always win. I know where my colonies are and when they're supposed to swarm. I rarely see ants in the house, but I expect them to be outside all the time.
That's where they belong.
Right.
That's where they're doing the most good. Right. Jody, as an urban entomologist, like, what is your perspective on ants? What is it that you hear complaints about the most, or what is it that you deal with most frequently in terms of the ant world?
If I get a call or an email and I get a picture of an ant, if the ant is in focus, it's 95% carpenter ant, because it's the ant big enough that people can take a picture of. Everything else is like just a blur, or they'll just say, well, it's really small. So like, I think here, at least in Nebraska, there's like big ants and small ants, and that's it. I don't think people realize like how many ants there are. And then identification is important, like all other potential pest issues. I think a lot of people fear carpenter ants, like what Mike was saying about termites. They think they're going to ruin their house, but they're also just annoying. They just don't like seeing them there. They just want to spray and get rid of them.
You mentioned that the species is important. Why is that when we're talking about ant control? Why do you need to know what kind of ant you're dealing with? Like, what changes the game species to species?
Yeah. So some ants are not going to be indoor pests at all. And other ones are going to be pests because their diet is very similar to ours. And so if we're going to drop something, and especially if we have like little kids, you give them a popsicle or something sweet and it drips, it's as easy as cleaning up that drip because, well, in Nebraska, like pavement ants are the first thing that is going to get to a spill. Just little things like that. But we've also got thief ants, which are known to be grease ants. And so certain ants will just nest in different places. So you do not have to do like a broad spectrum spray. That's not going to work to actually eliminate a colony. Just, you know, kill the foragers that are there. So knowing the species of ant will determine like the best way to manage them. So sometimes all you have to do is seal where they're coming in and feed them outside what they want to eat. If you only feed snacks to kids, like in your very fancy living room, that's where they're going to eat. You have to feed them out on the sidewalk so they can leave their crumbs out there.
They're going to go where the Oreo crumbs are. They know where they're at. Yeah.
Right. And like in my car and in my garage and driveway, if like I'm a salty person, so I love chips and crackers. If I drop anything like that in there, the pavement ants will get it right away. And so it's like, I know there's crumbs. I'll have to sweep it out into the driveway. But like the pavement ants and I are like this.
I like hearing that camaraderie. To go back to communism. when you're talking about controlling ants, though, I know that things can get kind of weird for people. Like they have this expectation of, well, I killed the 10 ants I saw in my kitchen yesterday. Why are they back? And why is this still happening? So what is it that you explain to them about killing the foragers and why that's not an effective method of IPM or pest control?
It's just kind of like any problem. Like you want to get to the source or the root of the problem and take care of that just rather than taking care of the symptoms, because they're still ultimately going to be that problem. So when people are like bug bombing their house, that's not going to work for ants because that's a space pesticide. And spraying, there's only a small percentage of the colony, which could be, you know, hundreds and thousands that are somewhere nesting with eggs and the larvae and the pupa. It's like a college dorm. And there's a couple that are sent out as foragers to go find the pizza. And they go find the pizza. They'll bring it back. They'll tell us where it is. You know, then we send more to go get the pizza.
all right, bro, where's
right? The Papa John's? If they go out to get the pizza,
I'm gonna follow you.
And like they get hit, fall over, they lose their way, something happens and they don't come back. You send more people to find pizza. So those are the foragers. They're expendable. They'll just send more. So if you kill those five ants that are by your sink, you're going to expect to see five more tomorrow. They've kind of laid the trail that maybe there's something good to eat here. They didn't come back, but they're just going to keep sending more. Well, do you follow them back after they take something? No. What do you do with them? I squish them. Well, that's not going to help. In order to get rid of the ant problem, you know, you need to find out where they're coming from. Are they coming from outside? Because most of the time they actually are coming from outside. Most of the ants nest outside. I don't know if that answered the question.
It does. Absolutely. And okay. I also kind of wondered if you could tag into it. I know in my experiences with folks that they buy the baits and then they see the ants going to the bait and then they kill the ants at the bait station. So there's this like impulse to control the ants as you see them. But you're talking about how there's more coming from somewhere else. You can seal things up to prevent them from getting inside. But if you've got ant baits out and you're using that as part of your management strategy, why should you avoid sealing up before you're done with the bait? And why should you avoid killing the ants that are visiting the bait station?
Yeah. And I think people confuse a bait station for a trap. So a trap, you're going to be trapped. You're stuck there. Bait stations, it's like a bar or a buffet. You go and you eat there and then you leave. And the idea is to take back that toxicant or the pizza to your family or your colony and feed each other, distribute that amongst the colony. And if there's a toxicant in it, you know, they may end up dying. And that's what you want to do. But if you go to get the pizza and you don't make it back to feed the colony, you know, that's not going to work. So you have to really refrain from squishing what you see. You need to let them eat and leave. And then you can follow them, find out where the colony is, and then they could take that bait down. So then they end up being able to lay a trail. So I think we did an episode about pheromones. I think it's like episode 83. I might've made that up. We talked about them laying a trail pheromone so that other ants could follow them back to that area. So they'll feed and people get really upset because then they end up seeing more ants, but you have to really not. The whole idea is to essentially poison the colony. And you can't do that if you're killing the ants that you see at the bait station.
I'm obsessed with your analogy of college students of like sending out your bros to go get pizza and they wander into a tent that's labeled tarot and they come back with a poisoned pizza. And
yeah. Like, look, we got this free pizza. Right. And then like they pass it out. Like there's so much of it. Hey, let's go back and get some more. Come with. Right. And then they all go and then they feed and you'll see like some of the ants, they come skinny and then they like, they're huge after. I think it's amazing. If you let them feed, then they go back. That's one of the roles or jobs of a worker is to feed other ants, to take care of the larvae, excavate nests. I mean, they're busy creatures. I love ants.
You sounds like you love pavement ants. They're pretty high on your list. You mentioned carpenter ants as well. So those are some common ones that you got there. Mike, what are some of your common ant species that you deal with as an extension professional?
I mean, we've talked about this a couple of times. A lot of the really common things get filtered out at the county office level. So I only end up getting like the really weird stuff. Maybe the most common thing that I get are citronella ants that are having nuptial flights indoors. And going back to what Jody was saying about identifying the ant species, citronella ants aren't pests. You know, they're out in the dirt. They feed on honeydew from root feeding aphids. Like they farm these aphids on plant roots. So they're not damaging structures. They're just outside. But sometimes when they have nuptial flights, when they have these mating flights, if they're next to a foundation and the foundation has cracks in it, they'll come in through the foundation and have that flight indoors. And so people don't have ants. And then all of a sudden they've got thousands or hundreds of winged ants in their basement. And that freaks them out because like, oh no, are these carpenter ants that are going to destroy my house? And they're not pests. They're just flying indoors because they want to mate and make a new colony. And then they'll go farm aphids somewhere else. So that's probably the most common one that I get, at least at certain times a year. Again, that's a good reason to identify your ants, because in that case, the solution is seal the cracks in the foundation to keep them out. You're not going to bait for them because they're not going to respond to baits. You're not providing them with pesticide laden aphids. They won't come to it. It's just exclusion.
Right. And at that stage, they're like when people are like, what can I do? I put out bait. I'm like, no, they're interested in mates, not bait. Right. Like they're not going to stop to eat.
Yeah, exactly. I think some of the other common ones that I get, the extension agents will often send up smaller carpenter ants. So we have two main species of carpenter ants in at least this area. The eastern black carpenter ants, Camponotus pennsylvanicus, they're the big black species that they excavate moist wood and can damage structural timbers and homes. But we have another species, the smaller carpenter ant, Camponotus nearticus. They're in different subgenera. And smaller carpenter ants don't excavate. They are cavity nesters, so they'll find a natural cavity and nest in it, but they won't expand it at all. So out in the woods, they're nesting in things like broken branches or natural cavities in trees. But in homes, particularly, they'll get around like the wall void and windows. Like there's a nice void space there and they'll make a nest in there. And so people will see them running around and they get worried because they look like carpenter ants. They are carpenter ants. They're just little. And people get worried, like, I'm seeing these carpenter ants in my house. Are they destroying the structure? And then you're like, well, no, they're just void nesters. Put some baits out, put a perimeter spray down to kill them, but seal up the cracks that are letting them come in.
Do you recommend baits for carpenter ants? Because usually that one gets tricky, especially here.
Carpenter ants are hit or miss with baits. I usually tell people to try two or three different baits before they give up on them. A thing to consider with baits is that they're either protein or carbohydrate based. And depending on the nutritional needs of the colony, they may or may not respond to a specific bait. You know, if they're looking for lipids or they're like grease ants, that's what they really want most of the time. And you put out a sugar bait, they may not respond to it at all. They'll just walk right past it. So you may need to try two or three different baits before you hit on one that they like. Like, is there a place on the packaging that they say what they're based on? Or do they, because I've never been able to find it. Or do you just like have to know or have to guess, like try different brands?
You taste it.
That seems
that's bad advice.
I don't think
taste ant baits.
Don't eat the ant bait. I don't think it says on there because I think that would be included in the inert ingredients because I've read a lot of ant bait labels and I have like a whole sheet on the ones that are commercially available for homeowners. You know, everyone thinks of taro, but I'm like, there are actually this many types of bait. They come in different forms, which is either liquid or ready to use or the solid cakey looking thing, the steak that goes in the ground, things you pour, all different ones. But it will say like for most common ants. And then I think that's a sugar bait. If it's a dual, I think maybe it has a little bit of protein, but it always has a sugar, but it will usually say on there, like not for carpenter ants. And then I assume that there's no protein in it.
Okay.
But most common ants, those will be sugar based.
Things like pavement ants and odorous house ants.
Acrobat ants, any of those things. And are acrobat ants pests inside homes where you guys are?
Yeah, they can be. They're another one. They're like the smaller carpenter ants. They're void nesters. So typically out in the world, they're going to be in like broken stems and branches and stuff. The few cases I get of them, and I've only gotten maybe five or six, there's almost always like a tree that is very close to the house and touching the house. So they're nesting in the tree and then climbing from the touching branch onto the house and coming in that way. So in that case, the solution is just prune your tree back and keep it away from the house. Mm-hmm. I've never baited for them. In the instances I've had a cultural control that works just as good or better.
Mm-hmm. And I think for some people, if they've done some kind of landscape change, you know, sometimes people are doing renovations or moving a deck or something and they'll see a bunch of ants and kind of freak out and think that they're going to infest or that there's a nest. And a lot of times, you know, the reason why they're replacing that wood siding deck is because it's decayed. And because of the decay, that symptom is ants. The ants haven't ruined your house. You know, there's some rotting or damage and the ants moved in.
They're a symptom.
Right. And I don't think people like that, but you know, that kind of happens.
How do you guys feel about perimeter sprays? Like if baits don't work?
I don't like them.
You don't?
No, for ants, I think if you want to really get rid of your ant problem, if you're not willing to use baits, then you need to find the nest and treat the nest directly. So you either have to drench it if it's a field ant, or you need to dust or spray or foam a carpenter ant nest to get rid of it. I don't really like doing broad spectrum spraying perimeter, because I don't think it's going to work for the ants, and it's going to kill other things that you maybe don't want to kill. But for the people that do it, they probably do want to kill everything.
Point, counterpoint, Mike.
I don't like broad spectrum sprays, but I have suggested fipronil based sprays. So Termidor and Taurus, because they tend to be more selective. They are fairly broad spectrum, but they are more selective to things that crawl across them, and they're slower acting. So especially with the Eastern black carpenter ants, when it's really difficult to find a colony, especially if it's like in your wall void and you can't treat it directly and you've tried baits and other things, I've suggested a fipronil perimeter spray, like a foundation spray. But you've got to be careful about that, because you don't want to be spraying like flowers and plants in the area. You've got to trim all that back.
So we've talked about some pest control. We've talked about the different kinds of species that are around us. What about some positive things with ants? We talked about some of the cool stuff with them, but do either of you have pet ants or colonies of ants that you keep yourselves?
No, but you know, I probably get an email once a month from someone saying, my kid really likes ants and we got an ant farm. Can you send us a queen ant? And my answer is no.
You don't just have one in your pocket?
No, I don't. Do you guys get that question? And where can they go to get a queen ant? Like, do you buy those or can you dig one up? And how do you know it's going to start a colony?
I do get that question frequently. Like, people want to start their own colony. They want to know what ant queen is the easiest to find and how they harvest them. And I have a tough time with that one. I don't really know where to tell. Some of them want to buy it on Amazon or what have you. But I think that Mike has some experience with it. So what would be your advice to these folks?
I've gotten a couple questions like that, and there are a bunch of different answers. There's a lot of information about it. First, it's illegal to ship, I think, any or most ant species queens across state lines. So don't do that. You can't mail. That's why you can't mail order queens, is because it's illegal to ship them. But in Pennsylvania, at least, we were lucky enough. There was two high school kids that started a small company where they would catch queens and start a small colony and then sell that within the confines of Pennsylvania. So there was a mail order business out of Philadelphia, if you're a Pennsylvania resident, that you could buy ant queens and colonies from. It's really easy during certain times of year to catch your own queens if you want to start your own colony. After spring rains or after rains during the summer, you'll find that's typically when ants are swarming. They use often weather cues to time swarming emergences across like a broad area. The day or two after that, you can go out and if you've got some sidewalk or pavement or something, you can walk along and you'll often see ant queens scurrying along. And you can tell that they're queens because they're ants with wings that are outside of the colony. You can catch those, and sometimes they'll be delated. They'll have dropped their wings already. Once you've seen one or a couple of them, you can pick up an eye for it, where you can recognize the queen running along because they'll typically have a bigger abdomen. They look a little bit different. They're kind of, I don't know, ungainly. They walk differently than worker ants. So if you've seen one or a couple, you can get that search image and find ant queens fairly regularly. And then you can, you know, put her in like a test tube with some wet cotton at the bottom or another small container, and she'll start to rear out her first set of eggs and first set of workers. And you can build a colony from a queen that you collected yourself fairly easily. The other thing that you could do is go flip rocks or break open rotten logs and find certain species. If you can find the queen that way, you can catch her and some workers and some brood and basically start your own pre-started colony from a wild colony. One of the researchers here at Penn State did a lot of work with carpenter ants and zombie ant fungus. And so to get their carpenter ant colonies going, you just go out into the woods and bust open some rotten logs and you'll be able to catch the queen and, you know, start your own colony that way. And that's what they did for their lab colonies. So you can do that. There's a lot of really good information online now, especially with YouTube. There's a bunch of different people putting out ant content, but Ants Canada is probably the best. They have a lot of instructional videos about how to care for an ant colony, how to make your own formicarium. They do sell pre-made formicaria in Outworlds if you want to just purchase it instead of making your own. I would suggest starting there if you haven't done it before and just watch some videos, especially again from Ants Canada. They have a lot of great content. It's certainly a lot better of an information landscape now than 20 years ago for keeping ant colonies from scratch with a queen.
Did you have an ant colony?
As a child?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had like the green whatever one like plastic one that you would order.
Uncle Milton's or something?
Yeah, that you'd order harvester ants from, which seems like a terrible idea now because harvester ants sting. Huh. Like they're one of the species that have a pretty decent sting to them too. Like it's okay to ship workers, but not queens because workers can't reproduce. They'll just die. And that's the problem with like those kind of commercial ant colonies is you get, you know, a voucher for workers and then they live for a couple of weeks and all die out and then you've got to buy more. But it seems weird or crazy in retrospect that we're shipping these stinging ants all over to children. But yeah, I did have some ant colonies as a child.
I've seen some of those videos and it's like kind of a rabbit hole. It's pretty neat. Like
it really is.
They're giant formicariums where they add water and where they have the brood. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. You can really get into it. Like we've got keeping ants to the point of keeping like a lot of other pets. Like there's a lot of information, a lot of detail. You can keep multiple species. They all have different requirements.
I have a question for both of you guys. So you talked a little bit about aphid farming. Mm-hmm. And so we know that aphids are plant feeding pests, suck the juices out, and ants kind of farm them because they like the honeydew that they produce. For agricultural crops, that's not very good. So do you think that ants are not beneficial in that area because they keep the aphids there and protect them?
There is some evidence for that with scales in particular. There was a study that got done in Dan Potter's lab here a few years ago. I think it involved calico scale or a different species of soft scale. And they demonstrated that if you excluded ants from trees by wrapping the base of the tree with a sticky band so the ants couldn't get over to the scales and protect them, the scales suffered and the trees flourished afterwards. So there actually was sort of a link between ant farming of these honeydew developing insects and the health of the plant.
Yeah. So like the ant is like the ultimate bodyguard.
Pretty much, I would say like they're keeping all kinds of different things away, right, Mike? Like things that want to eat the scales and aphids, things that want to lay their eggs in them. I mean, they're pretty vicious when they need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they're protecting aphids, they'll defend them from predators and parasitoids really well. I mean, that's the benefit to the aphids for secreting the honeydew.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you go out and see like a milkweed plant and there's like an ant on every leaf or anywhere you go and you see like an ant, there's got to be aphids here. And people don't realize that. And there's a lot of sugar outside for them. A lot. There's, you know, little aphid butts producing sugar for them all the time.
Sugary butt juice is delicious, apparently. I mean, you'll fight to the death for it.
So I did some of my postdoc research was on cattail aphids. And most cattails have aphids on them, but sometimes they're really difficult to find. Like one stand might only have one or two cattails that are infested. But halfway through the research, I realized like, if I look for the ants that are tending the aphids, it makes them a lot, like I don't have to pull apart 20 cattail plants to find the aphids. I just like scout around, like there's a lot of ants at the base of that one. I bet that one has aphids. And 9 times out of 10, it did.
You use them like bird dogs.
I did. It worked. Once you get an eye for it, you can see it. And it's really like, it's really obvious once you learn how to see.
Build that search pattern, Mike.
Yeah. But that also gets at another way to control them around the house. Like if you've got aphids on planting beds and then you're getting ants inside, if you can control the aphids, that may be a way to also control the ants by eliminating a food source.
Yeah. So when you see an ant and you don't want it there, ask yourself, like, why is it here? Did it just wander in? Is it feeding on something in my house? Is it in my rafters? Do I have a lot of plants outside? And then, you know, manage it from there if it needs to be.
A lot of people don't think about the fact that ants are fairly diverse. Like they see an ant and all ants are the same, but really they're not. Each species does its own thing and has its own unique ecology and lifestyle.
Life history.
There are 700 species in 80 genera in the United States and Canada. There's only a small percentage that are ever pests.
Do you have the Argentine ant there, either of you?
No, we don't have Argentine ants here.
I haven't heard about Argentine ants. I've gotten a few inquiries about Faroe ants recently. My coworker, Rick Besson, was recently stung by Asian needle ants that gotten in his shirt after he was swimming. And I know we're being invaded in the Land Between the Lakes area by imported fire ant. So Kentucky is sort of a beachhead right now for some problematic ant species. But we'll fight the good fight against some of those.
Are they moving in due to flooding?
The theory right now is, yeah, that they floated up from Tennessee into the Land Between the Lakes area and have gotten semi-established there. You can drive around and see some of the mounds. Wow. If you know what you're looking for, as Mike mentioned a couple of times. So far, they haven't been found outside of there, but there's some concern about people who bale up alfalfa and grass and stuff and ship it out for hay, and people that sell soil in the area. It seems like a good way that it could get out of that contained spot and into the rest of Kentucky. You asked about the Argentine ant.
Oh, yeah.
I looked it up on Ant Wiki. Kentucky has no records, but it looks like there's it's introduced in Pennsylvania and Nebraska.
What? So yeah, I've kind of been on the lookout. But the thing about the Argentine ants is that they form, like we always talk about, like ants are a super organism, but they form these super colonies. So when we see like pavement ants doing pavement ant war things, you know, when there's like these piles of, it just looks like this hairy mess in the sidewalk cracks. And it's basically two colonies of the same species fighting each other for territory or whatnot. And it's pretty vicious and kind of awesome. With Argentine ants, I guess they don't do that. They are all so close genetically that they just join and there's no aggression. And so they have these giant super colonies. So in Europe, there is a colony that's 3,728 miles.
Wow.
I think even in California, there's a couple like super colonies so they can stretch. Yeah, miles and miles and miles, and there's no aggression between them.
So the Argentine ants, they're dolichoderide ants. They're related kind of to odorous house ants. And so one of the issues that we have with odorous house ants is that they have multiple queen colonies. That's why they're so hard to control. With carpenter ants, they have one queen per colony. So if you can get that poison that you're baiting with into the queen and she dies, then the colony dies out. The problem with odorous house ants is because they have multiple queens, if you kill one queen, it doesn't really matter. The colony's still there. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that they can do that is the queens are related. You know, it'll be one founding queen and then her offspring will fly, mate, and then come back and rejoin the colony and act as, you know, secondary queens in that same colony. So they're all related. Argentine ants do a similar thing where, you know, the queens go up, they fly, then they come back. And because they're all related, like you mentioned, there's no aggression because they're all sisters. Because mm-hmm. Argentine ants are introduced here, there's no genetic diversity. And so everybody is related to everybody else because they came in once. So by default, by founder effect, all of them in the colony are related, which is why they can make those super colonies.
Yeah. And I also saw something about them being able to bud. How would you describe budding?
Yeah. So with budding, it's similar to how honeybees colonies split. You know, you have some workers and a queen, and they split off of the main colony and form another colony. Relating it back to odorous house ants, because that's what primarily we have here and what people will maybe be more familiar with. If you kill one or a couple queens in an odorous house ant colony, you can split that colony up. The remaining queens will go off in separate directions. And so now instead of one big colony, you've got multiple smaller colonies that now you've got to like track down and kill. And it, you know, that is, I guess, a form of budding where you break the colony up like that with multiple queens going in multiple directions.
Mm-hmm. That could be a reason why not to also spray if you don't exactly know where the nest is. Maybe mm-hmm. you can separate them. Speaking of odorous house ants, what do you think it smells like? So for people that don't know, there are a couple ants that you can like smash and sniff to identify.
No, you can. I love it.
Yeah. So sometimes, you know, people will laugh, but I'll be like, oh, what does it smell like? You don't want to sniff it up into your nose, like the ant. You don't want to snort the ant, but you want to smell. And they have distinct smells, but I'm not very good sensory description wise. The books will say rotting coconut. I don't know what that smells like, but it smells like odorous house ant to me. What do you think?
You tried to rot a coconut, didn't you?
I did try to rot a coconut and sniff it, but it molded and it didn't smell like an odorous house ant.
I agree. A lot of the descriptors don't make sense. Like I also don't know what a rotting coconut smells like, or like rotting bananas. Again, not quite sure what that smells like. It has its distinct smell though. Like if you blindfolded me and put one under my nose, I'd know that it's an odorous house ant. Like it's unique.
Right.
It's just difficult to describe.
Yeah. I think there was a paper saying the molecules are similar to blue cheese.
Ooh, I love blue cheese.
Blue cheese. So, and I don't know if it's suggested, like if you can smell it and you're like, does it smell like blue cheese? Maybe. Citronella ants, they're called that because the workers, when you disturb them, you don't even have to squish them. You just lift up a rock and you'll smell citronella. I haven't smelled all the ants. Like I haven't, I don't, I wonder what an Argentine ant smells like.
I now know one of your bucket list items.
Smell all the ants.
Smell all the ants.
I think it was really surprising too that the number one most painful sting was a bullet ant. Like I think that really like kind of helped the ant be like super tough and painful, right? I guess when it came to stinging, like people maybe like count ants out.
That's true. I think they forget about them. They were always like, oh, the hornets, the bees, right. The wasps.
It's like the tarantula hawk. And then the number one sting on like the Schmidt sting pain index was the bullet ant.
Sneaks up behind you and gets you.
I know.
It doesn't sneak up behind me and get me.
So a lot of the information that I get or file for ID, I use Urban Ants of North America and Europe, Identification, Biology, and Management, Klotz et al.
Mike, what do you got, an ant book or?
I think the one that I use the most is the Ant Genera of North America. If you're looking to identify ants, Ants of North America, it's a guide to genera. It's got really nicely illustrated keys to all the genera, a one-page layout for each genus with, you know, range and photographs and descriptions. If you're looking to break into ant identification, it is like the first place to go. Ants, compared to other diverse groups, are often fairly easy to identify. So from a budding taxonomist identifier point of view, I really like using them as an entry point into entomology.
Well, I think it's important to understand that ants are just living in your landscape. Don't be surprised if you see a couple wandering across your driveway, spill out of your garden bed when you're digging, or form a trail that looks like a parade leading into maybe your living space. They don't hate humans. They're just being ants. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you've learned something about ants that you didn't know before. Mike, did you want to plug our next episode and provide any instructions for listeners that may want to provide input?
Yeah. We're going to wrap up the Napoleon versus Insect series on the next episode. We'll be interviewing Everett Rummage, the host of the Age of Napoleon podcast. If you, the listeners, have any specific questions that you want us to ask on the air, get us your question some way, somehow, and we'll try to work it into the show.
Cool. Thanks, Mike. Jonathan, do you have any announcements before we wrap up?
Don't. I just think that people should find us on the web at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. They can send us an email through there if they have their questions ready. They can find the show on Twitter, arthro_podshow, and hit us up there with a direct message or a subtweet and let us know what they want us to ask Everett Rummage. Or they can just say, you know, hey, how's it going? This is my favorite ant. I wish I was a big-headed ant or a turtle ant or a bullet ant. We would love to hear those kinds of things. You can find me on Twitter. I am at BugmanJohn on the Bad website.
And I am at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at MScavarla36.
And we look forward to joining Everett here soon to talk more about Napoleon and wrap that up. And we hope that you will join us for another entomology podcast time.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
A podcast time.
It's a podcast time. We're having a great time on the podcast.
What's the audio equivalent of that?
I think it would be like, stand by.